Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Drug and Alcohol Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Rebecca McClure. Please go ahead.
Hi there. This is Rebecca McClure. I'm a care manager for the Eden Prairie outpatient team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you will not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of this conference, you will be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After the survey, you'll be asked complete questions on today's seminar. For materials on today's seminar, please visit us online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side, click on Visit Our Education and Resources page and click on Drug and Alcohol Awareness. Then click on Drug and Alcohol Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. Scroll to the bottom of the screen to today's date, and you'll find today's handouts. Please note that not all policies cover today's topic. For more specific information on your policy cover topics discussed in today's seminar, please contact the outpatient team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Today I have the pleasure of introducing Tessa Vining. Tessa is the director of Phoenix House's Impact Program, an intervention program for adolescents and their families who are struggling with substance abuse. Tessa has been with Phoenix House since 2005, and during her tenure she has expanded the scope of the outpatient services to include four tracks of treatment. Joining Tessa today is Lauren Wicks. Lauren is a member of the Parent Advisory Board at the Partnership for DrugFree.org. She is a mother and an advocate for families dealing with drug and alcohol addiction. And I'm handing it over to you, Tessa.
Great. Thank you, Rebecca. Hello, everyone. The purpose of today's discussion is to highlight how you as caregivers and treatment providers can support your loved one's continued recovery from alcohol and drugs. We at Phoenix House look at addiction through the complex web of family systems. So I will be specifically talking to the caregivers today about how to plan for your loved one's completion of treatment, supporting them after they leave treatment, and how to handle the reality of relapse in a positive, healthy way. With me today is Lori Wicks, who will introduce herself to you in a minute and who will speak from the perspective of a parent who supported her son through the transition of completing a treatment program and his reintegration back into his home and community. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you, Tessa, and hi, everyone. Thank you for having me today. I am pleased to be representing the partnership at DrugFree.org as one of its parent advisory board members. Again, my name is Lori Wicks. And my youngest son is in long-term recovery, which means that he has not used alcohol or drugs for over 2 years. I'm speaking out about our experience because our child's long-term recovery has helped us change our lives for the better, as we will be talking about today, and I'd like to help make it possible for others to do the same. I have three children. My youngest, whom I talk about today, was really a happy and contented child growing up. He was a delight, even as a baby. He was the one that would wake up with a smile while he was laying in his crib, contented and giggling, and this is something that was always very amazing to me. Through preschool and elementary school and middle school, he was really happily and deeply engaged in the things that kids do during those years, making friends and having fun and exploring sports, and then towards the later course of that time period, getting interested in girls. He really also at school just independently worked to get good grades. On his own, he had developed these great study habits. He would do his homework without our prompting. He was really just a low-maintenance kid. On many occasions during, you know, parent-teacher conferences or just events at school, we would be taken aside by teachers and even principals who wanted to personally share with us how much that they enjoyed having him in their classes and, you know, just simply having him part of the school, that he had a positive impact on others, you know, the students, and that it was visible, that he was respectful and kind and caring and fun. And About 2 years into high school, all of that changed rather suddenly when we discovered, and we were mystified as parents by this actually, that he had been experimenting with smoking pot. Right under our noses, in our own house, and we didn't even know it. We had sat down and had a family meeting about this, and he came clean and explained that it was really a bad decision, that he hadn't planned on doing it again, and we believed him. Not too long after that, maybe it was about 4 months later, we as a family encountered another seriously shocking blow. It was his failed suicide attempt. He had taken a knife from the kitchen to his bedroom with the plan of slitting his wrists. And again, it was right in our house, actually in the bedroom right next to ours and right under our noses. This was followed by an immediate inpatient stay. And this was a shock to the whole family and his friends. He had really mastered the art of presenting a happy exterior when not one of us had any idea of what he was experiencing internally. And as a parent, this was really excruciatingly painful to realize. You know, as a standard protocol, when he was discharged, he had been sent for a drug and alcohol assessment, and the outcome of that was that we were assured that any drug or alcohol use before his stay in the hospital was simply experimental. And then the months that followed that were really a period of deep concern for us as parents and a family, for his continuing health and well-being. His grades had slipped heavily at school, and we really attributed this to his months of outpatient treatment that took up most of his time, and which in our minds were really of a higher priority than his grades. And the following summer was really taken up, that was between his junior and senior year, filled with summer school so that he could catch up where he had fallen behind the year prior with his condition. But also during that summer, some other new and unfamiliar behaviors started to show up too. He had come home late after curfew and impaired a couple of times, and this was so just incredibly out of character. We talked about it with him, and we talked about his treatment about it with his treatment professionals, and it was ultimately chalked up to more teenage experimentation. And then things began to stabilize. He brought his grades up. He was always home by curfew. His physician was even planning to begin to wean him from his medication, another standard protocol. Then just a week before Christmas, all of that changed literally overnight when I had discovered him or found him asleep on the couch in the basement, and there was drug paraphernalia neatly lined up on the coffee table next to him. It was an odd glass pipe and a razor blade. And really, it was this image, this visual image in my mind that jarred me into realizing the signs and symptoms that had, you know, he displayed over the past month or so, that at the time I thought odd but had dismissed quickly. It was just an intense rush of little things that went through my mind at that moment. There was missing money here and there. There were, you know, recaps of where he'd been and who he'd been with that just for some reason seemed to me to be, you know, lies or stories. Seeing that image on the coffee table next to him just jarred me into action as well, and we immediately drug tested him at home, and it was positive for opiates. And he said that it was because he had snorted Vicodin, and that was heartbreaking to us and very frightening as well. We had taken him for a professional drug and alcohol assessment, which happened to be fall on Christmas Eve morning. It was the first appointment that they had available. And to kind of shortcut and make a long story short. The following day, after that drug and alcohol assessment, is when we learned that our son was addicted to heroin, that he'd been either snorting heroin, or if he couldn't get heroin, then prescription drug substitutes like Opana. And he'd been doing that daily for the prior 6 months, at least the prior 6 months. The next day, we had dropped him off to detox at an adolescent facility about 3 hours away. And 4.5 months later, he was home and he was well. And today, two plus years later, and I am so immensely grateful to share that he is still well. And our family's experience with early recovery and our journey in supporting our child to sustain that long-term recovery is what will intersect with Tessa's presentation today. And Tessa?
Thank you, Lori. Thanks for sharing your story. Before I get into the meat of what I'm going to be talking about today, I want to just point you to some different supportive resources, and I'll also make mention to them again at the end of the presentation. But for information for clinicians or parents out there who are looking for help, Phoenix House has a website, which is www.phoenixhouse.org, and also an 800 number, which is 1-800-DRUG-HELP. And another great resource will be drugfree.org, so www.drugfree.org, along with their 800 number, which is 855-DRUG-FREE. So now to get back into the meat of the presentation, we're going to take a look at preparing for your loved one to come home. So hopefully while your loved one was in treatment, you began the process of understanding the disease of addiction, the exploration and purging of hurt feelings and resentments, opening lines to healthier communication, and now you're feeling more energized and probably terrified to welcome them back into the family fold. It's good to hold high hope in the positive changes that your loved ones made while in treatment, but you also have to be prepared for the reality that lifestyle changes are really hard to make and that there will be both big and small challenges for each of you every day, especially within the first year. So in preparing for their return from treatment, it's important to think about the following. We begin by identifying the many feelings that you have about their return home. So it's really normal to experience a whole range of feelings from being thankful to frightened. Most people express their feelings through behaviors or actions, so it's important to understand where your actions stem from. Understand that your loved ones also have a range of feelings about coming home, so it's important to sit down with them and address each one and the reason behind them. And by doing this, you're developing a mutual understanding of each other's hopes and fears. Secondly, changes need to be made. Everyone in the family needs to make changes, not just your loved one. I think a lot of times we hope that people, you know, the identified person who has the drug or alcohol problem goes into treatment, they'll fix what's wrong with them, and they'll come out and everything's perfect. But really, in order to be the most positive support in your loved one's life, you have to make changes as well. So it's important to ask yourself, to what extent are you willing to change? Areas that we feel at Phoenix House are important to address and make changes around are the following: creating house rules that apply to everyone, not just your loved one who has the problem with an addiction. To set more structure, rules, and limits, again, that rule goes for everyone. Create clear and consistent consequences when rules are broken. No alcohol or drugs in the house, and that, again, goes for everyone, which I think is a really important rule. To be open when one family member asks the other to change. To create more opportunity for your family to spend time together in a fun, drug, and alcohol-free way. To be less critical of each other, because you have to remember that change is really hard. and to assume the positive from each other, not the negative, and lastly, to create an open environment to communicate about problems. Now, Lori, have you had experience with making some of these changes in your household?
Absolutely. And actually, when our son, in preparation for his discharge from his inpatient treatment, we had designed, with the guidance of the treatment facility and his counselors there, a 90-day contract for when he arrived home. And it really provided for specific terms, which were behaviors expected of all of us when he was home. And they were really to guide us into creating new and better habits for living. And just, you know, the interaction among family members was a big one. You know, we need to be respectful of each other. We need to ensure that when any of us are talking that we're not interrupting the other. We need to really hone our listening skills and agree and understand that it's okay for other people, for each one of us to individually have our own perceptions or interpretations of things. And to understand how we can work together to keep those to keep things healthy. The 3 month the 90-day contract really for us created a tool for our son's recovery. It took the pressure off of us, and it took the pressure off of him as well, where we could almost refer to the set of rules, this tool, as a third party in our household. So that was very helpful.
Was it hard? Did you find it hard to change old family patterns? Was that something you had to look at?
I personally don't think that it was very hard for us. We were so invested and interested in our son's well-being that we really wanted to do anything that we could to help him become well and to stay well. That was really the most important thing to us. I think that probably one of the hardest things for us was when we had family meetings was to allow one person to finish speaking before the other person would start speaking.
Thank you. So we've touched upon a couple of things to consider when preparing for your loved one to come home. Again, identifying the feelings around coming home, looking at the family system and deciding on what changes need to be made for everyone. A third component that one needs to think about is deciding whether or not your loved one should live with you. This is a tough area to tackle, but it's an essential one. Being a family does not mean that everyone has to live together. I think that's important to understand. And some questions you need to ask yourself is, right now, is the best plan for your loved one to move back to your home? It might not be. And also thinking through, is there somewhere else that you think your loved one would be better off? Maybe you have someone in your household who's not willing to give up alcohol or drugs, and it'll be around the house, and you just don't feel it's a safe environment. Or the community that you're living in was the community that your loved one was using pretty heavily in and involved in, and that might not be the safest place either. If you decide not to live together, then it's important to decide how you will stay connected, because as I mentioned before, being a family does not mean you have to live together, so you still have that opportunity. So you have to decide how you will stay connected, how often you'll see each other, how you'll stay in communication, things like that. Lastly, we have to plan for and set expectations around certain themes. And the themes we're going to look at in depth for preparing to come home are educational and job goals, continued recovery support, social life, school and work, family time, and responsibilities. So what I'm going to do is go over each of these themes, and then Lori's going to interject some of, you know, her preparation with her youngest son around these goals. So the first theme would be educational and job goals. So what strengths or resources does your loved one have that will help them achieve these goals? And what will you commit to doing to support these goals? So things such as financial assistance if they're going to be going to school. Transportation, can you help them get back and forth to school, to work? Freedom from other responsibilities and emotional support. Lori, did you guys have to think those through educational goals for your youngest son?
We certainly did. When he was discharged initially from rehab, he was just, gosh, I think 15 days shy of his high school graduation. And with the events of that time period, he was required to attend those last several days of high school in order to graduate. And he chose for his own reasons not to attend that graduation ceremony, really simply because he felt it would put him at high risk for exposure, and he wanted to avoid that. Once we got through the summer and started thinking about his future, and you know, many of his peers were headed off to college or looking for full-time jobs, we felt as a family that it was more important for him to prioritize his recovery in his life before really diving into any other long-term commitment. That he needed to get a good foothold and really put recovery events or recovery, I guess events, to put that first and find that and to make a place on every day of his life for what he needs for his recovery. And we encouraged him to really defer starting school for at least 6 months. And that when he was starting school, to encourage him to take it slow. And we had not in any way changed the course of how we had planned to support him, you know, in this part of his life before addiction came into our lives. Mm-hmm. He had, agreed that would be a good process or pathway for him to take. And you know, his professional counselors at the time agreed with that approach for us as a family. So he took it slow and then, you know, started school with just two courses 6 months later and ended up getting a 4.0, I might add. So.
Nice. Well, as a clinician, it's nice to hear that type of support because, you know, we often see parents putting a lot of pressure around education and wanting their child to come back and, you know, walking graduation because it's a big milestone and putting the pressure on their child even though it might not be the right thing for the child. So I applaud that support on your behalf.
Thank you. You know, it worked for us and worked for him. So.
Yeah. Nice. Well, our next theme we're going to look at is continuing care, so continued recovery support. So it's crucial to think of substance abuse like any other chronic disease. So it needs to be managed even after the crisis period is over. So it's important to set expectations around what your loved one will do to continue to support all of the positive changes that they made while they were in treatment. So some questions to ask would be, will they attend outpatient treatment or self-help groups such as NA or AA? How long will they do this for? And you also have to think of continued care not only in regards to substance misuse, but also other services that they might need to continue, such as psychiatric support or medical care, maybe family therapy or job training or education. And, of course, thinking about how you will be involved in continuing care is also very important. Lori, did you come up with a plan for continued care?
Yes, and actually that was initiated by the discharging facility, and they had recommended a plan of aftercare for for our son. That involved us as well as really involved the initial 90-day contract. During that time period, of course, our son as well as us were to continue to work on our recovery. And, you know, I don't think we've talked about this yet, Tessa, but just to throw out there that recovery is not just for the person who is in recovery from substance use. It's also the entire family that's in recovery. So we as a family needed to find our mechanisms for supporting our own recovery as well, independent from our son, then also together with him. He did have a treatment plan that he invested himself in right away. It was recommended that he become part of a 12-step fellowship, which he did. He was required from the terms of the contract, the home care contract, or the home contract, to get to one 12-step meeting a day for the first 90 days. And he found it was it was an environment that was so helpful for him that he would sometimes attend more than one fellowship meeting a day, and also continued that on for more than a year. It has really enriched his life, and you know, he made his way through the entire 12 steps through a period of time and shared a lot of that with us as he went through them and his experience going through them. And one of the remarks that I often think back on him saying or sharing with us is that he really felt that they were just an essential component to anyone's life, not just anyone in recovery. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So, yes, he has continued in his aftercare program, which he was ultimately or eventually discharged from, but he's very active also in helping others through that continuing care as well.
Thank you. The next thing we're going to look at is social life. So when it comes to your loved one's peers, take a hard look at who's been a positive force in your loved one's life, who's been a negative force, and who you're both on the fence about. So it's important to set expectations about whether or not one should hang out with these negative or so-so people, and also to realize how the positive ones can be used as an additional support. And for all those parents out there of teens, I do recommend setting rules around curfew, what friends they can see, and what are some positive pro-social activities that they can participate in, and also what places and things are potential triggers for them to help them identify those. It's, you know, when one comes out of treatment, they have to reintegrate back into their community and break old patterns and old habits. So it's important to be very concrete about what's positive and what can be a potential pitfall. Lori?
Yes, we actually as a family took that component very seriously. One of the small things that we did that really had some long-term positive effects that our son thought at first was very silly, but now really agrees that it was a very good thing to have done, was we changed his cell phone number. And right off the bat, that eliminated any type of incoming communication that he would really have no control over. Again, it seems like such a simple maneuver that really may not necessarily have that great of an impact, but in the long run, in our experience, it really did. He had defined on his own, which was part of his preparation for Integration Home, those people, places, and things that he knew he needed to avoid that upon his return home, that we had supplemented as well. He knew, and he took that very seriously. his social life was very limited for probably the first year to really just family and his fellowship, which really gave him enough of an environment to exist within that was healthy and positive. So that was a really big intersect, I think, to setting the foundation for his long-term recovery. And he took it very seriously.
And that's one of the hardest areas, I find, for many people, especially teenagers.
Yeah, you know, if we could take a look at his life before and after, there are no people, none, that were in his life before, even from when he was a young boy, now. It's completely different, and I think that's another part of recovery that a lot of people have difficulty comprehending, such a drastic change, especially at that age, you know, when you're at the end of adolescence. That's a really tough thing. But I think it really helped in our situation.
Yeah, I agree with that. The fourth theme would be school and work, so it's important to set achievable goals in this area. For example, if your child was barely passing school last year, don't expect them to all of a sudden get all A's. And do expect them to go to school every day, but don't expect them to be the star pupil in everything they do. So you want to have realistic expectations. Set an expectation for school around attendance, extracurricular activities, their behavior, and their grades. And likewise, for work, you want to set expectations around work hours, type of jobs that one is taking, such as you don't want a person working in a bar, what their financial contribution will be to the family, and how to balance with all other responsibilities, such as one's recovery program. So school and work are important, but you don't want them to be in place of one's recovery program. And lastly, the last theme we want to take a look at would be family time and responsibilities to the family. So what are your expectations about your loved one's involvement in family life? How many meals will you try to eat together? Who will cover child care? When and how often? How will you spend fun time together as a family? What are each person's chores and responsibilities? Will there be an allowance? Are you expected to contribute to the family financially? So setting down all of these things clearly and also brainstorming fair consequences that should result from not following the rules, but also things given to them for if the rules are being followed. So besides the one thing I do want to touch upon is besides the regular relapse triggers such as former drug using friends and old hangouts, it's also really important to recognize that family issues can also be a huge trigger. So it's important to sit down and identify the potential pitfalls and come up with a plan to address these. Lori, do you have any experience with how you guys structured the family responsibilities?
We do, and you know, the first 90 days or first 3 months, really we fell back on the terms of that home contract that we had all put together, that we had all contributed to put that final contract together. And it did include household chores for our son and expectations for what he would need to do to contribute to the home environment and his earnings. As you know, what we expected him to contribute with his earnings from work. And also, you know, it did set forth consequences of, and I'm not sure we're ready to talk about that yet, but the consequences of poor behaviors, which would, you know, include using again. One of the big things that we had, I think it's not unique. I think it's required. I think it's essential for recovery to cut out in the family, especially the home environment, any alcohol or, you know, drug use, if that's applicable. What we did as parents is we, when our son was in rehab, cut alcohol completely out of our lives. And 3 months prior to our son being admitted for rehab treatment, I had also quit smoking after 30 years. So with the help of our son, and what I'm getting at is he had introduced us to a tradition that we did every evening together, the three of us. Our older children were already out of the house. And we would sit down and go through what my son referred to as a 10th step. And he taught us as parents how to do this. And every night for 3 months, we would sit down and talk about things that we were grateful for that occurred that day. We would talk about whether we had triggers or urges to use. And in my case, that would be nicotine. We would talk about what we were looking forward to in the following day, and also we would talk about anyone who we felt that we may have owed amends for from that day. It turned out to be a really meaningful event for all of us and really kept us in tune with what our son was dealing with in terms of triggers and urges that he may experience that really was so out of scope of anything that we could understand from based on our own experience. And I, you know, relate my urges or triggers with nicotine to that, but I think it's probably entirely different than what he has experienced on his own. That was one of the things we had done. The other thing relating to alcohol is before he came home, we had really prepared our house, our home, for him to come back. And in doing so, we cleansed our home of anything containing alcohol or anything in our home that could potentially be used or abused, I guess, as a to become impaired. So any over-the-counter medications, all prescription medications, household cleaners, anything that contained alcohol, we got them out of the house. The computer duster out of the house, all of those kinds of things. And what we were really attempting to do, and at the guidance of the discharging facility, was to create a safe haven for our son. So when he was out reintegrating back into his community and his life, he would know that he would have a safe place to return to where there would be no risks for him at all. And, you know, one of the other pieces that we did in giving up alcohol as a family is we also decided ahead of time that for an entire year, and this would be written into his contract as well, that we would forfeit any family events that occurred, meaning extended family events such as weddings or funerals or picnics. Celebrations, anything where alcohol was being served, we would not be attending for his first year in recovery. And that's what we did as a family. And I think in our experience, although it was very, very hard and tough, we really missed our family and those social events, but it was so important to cut the exposure for him in our minds. So that was one of the things that we did.
Great. It's a big thing, too.
It was big.
Yeah. So remembering in the preparation for one's return home, it's important to remember that yours and your loved one's goals can be very different. So, you know, as it might seem a little bit much or a little bit extensive to go through all these topics and really write things down, we highly recommend doing it because your goals could be very different. So it's important to be able to sit down and discuss those differences before they return home. Now, after all this planning and preparation, you and your loved one are ready to exit treatment. So now what's next? They're finally coming home. It is important to understand that family reunification is extremely challenging for everyone. You've gotten used to family life without your loved one, and now suddenly they're back in the mix. At first, things will probably go smoothly. Everyone's going to be on their best behavior. But, you know, after a month or two, you do start hitting some bumps in the road. For some families, the solution lies in counseling. You might want to talk to your loved one's counselor about family meetings or get a referral to a nearby therapist. But either way, you probably need to work together to figure out new ways to be a family. Some families prefer the less professional route, so they might attend 12-step meetings such as Al-Anon or Nar-Anon, or they might get support from friends who've already been down that path. It's also important to look at healthy coping strategies, which are very important during this time, and they're different for everyone. So what you want to do is create a list around healthy ways you can cope. So I'm not talking about the person coming home, but you as their caregiver, you creating healthy coping strategies. So some examples may include, again, attending self-help groups, getting support from church, your church or friends, exercising, going for walks, meditating, whatever helps you. And as much as it's important to identify the healthy coping strategies, it's also helpful to be aware of your own unhealthy coping strategies. So when they're kicking in, you want to be able to recognize those. For some people, that might include sleeping too much or too little, gambling excessively, a lot of negative self-talk or giving into guilt or blame, or dwelling on angry, bitter, or worried thoughts. Lori, can you speak to some of the things you did to help you when your son came home?
Yes. Really, while he was in rehab, I tried as much as I could to research and understand the condition and really became or tried to get connected as much as I could to the advocacy community and to connect with others who were in the same circumstance as we were. I found that to be very helpful, and I also, read a lot, which goes along with the research. One of the things that we did as a family is, and this was written into the contract as well, the first 90-day contract, is that we, if anyone had any type of issue or concern, we immediately would call a family meeting, and we would talk about it right then and there and try to remain non-defensive, and if it would escalate, which it never did, but if it were to escalate to where we needed some type of help, we would contact his outpatient counselor and have a family meeting there. So those were the things that helped us as a family.
Right. Now, relapse has to be discussed because, unfortunately, it is common in the disease of addiction. And it's important, though, to look at relapse as not a failure on your loved one's part. I can't stress that enough. It's very important to look at it as not a failure, but as an opportunity to grow and become stronger. And relapse does not mean recovery is no longer possible. Relapse is more than just a return to the use of alcohol and drugs. It's usually a return to old ways of being and thinking. So not all relapses are the same. Some are brief, and we call those slips, and others are longer and more complicated, and those could be thought of as a fall. But in general, people who admit their relapse right away and get back on track with their recovery plan are able to reduce the problems that come with a return to drugs and alcohol. So in saying that, it's just really important to be aware of what the relapse warning signs are, because relapse starts long before one actually starts to drink or use drugs, and you want to be familiar with the warning signs, and you should address them. And it shouldn't be a confrontational conversation, but basically sharing your concern. And in sharing your concern, it's really helpful if you're giving concrete examples of the behavior that you see that's worrying you. And just lastly, I briefly want to just touch upon ways to support your loved one while they're home. And some of those themes are helping encourage healthy relationships, because everyone needs to have supportive people around them in order to be successful. You want to advocate for your loved one if they're, involved in, they need special services or supports. Sometimes those systems are hard to navigate through, so you could really be a good support and a help by advocating for them. Understanding each other's triggers, which we've touched upon briefly before. And most importantly, to be proud, because recovering from addiction is extremely difficult. And you want to recognize the new path your loved one has chosen and the hard work put into making positive changes. So you wanna really think about that and accept it and express it to them as well, because it's good for them to hear. And we're at the end of our presentation now, but I just want to remind you again of the helpful resources we have out there, which would be the Phoenix House website, which is phoenixhouse.org, and the 800 number, which is 1-800-DRUG-HELP, and also the www.drugfree.org, along with their 800 number, which is 855-DRUG-FREE. Thank you for being with us today.
To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Please tell us the degree to which you agree or disagree with the following statements. Question 1. This session provided me with information on how to address relapse and support recovery for my loved one. Press star 1 if you strongly agree, star 2 if you agree, star 3 if you disagree, and star 4 if you strongly disagree. Question 2. This session educated me on what to do to support my loved one's recovery. Press star 1 if you strongly agree, star 2 if you agree, star 3 if you disagree, and star 4 if you strongly disagree. Question 3. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Press star 1 if you strongly agree, star 2 if you agree, star 3 if you disagree, and star 4 if you strongly disagree. Question 4. I would recommend this program to others. Press star 1 if you agree or star 2 if you do not agree. Question 5. Please select the response to best describe your role in the life of an individual with substance abuse issues. Press star 1 for I am the parent of a child with substance abuse issues. Star 2 for I am a family member of someone with substance abuse issues. Star 3 for other. Thank you for your feedback and for participating in our program. If you would like to make any additional comments to help us improve this program or have any questions on today's topic, press star 1 to have your line open into the conference. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Please be aware that a voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. At that point, please state your name before posing your question. Once again, please press star 1 to be placed in a queue to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment. And we'll take our first question.
Hi, my name is Cindy, and actually I missed the website at the beginning where you said we could get the educational handouts.
This is Rebecca. The website is CignaBehavioral.com.
Okay. And you said, was it on the right-hand side that it said visit the educational handout?
You're going to go to the left-hand side, and then you're going to click on visit our education and resource page, and then you're going to click on drug and alcohol awareness. And when I clicked on it, it said something like alcohol awareness. That may have, it's one of the two of them. And then you're going to go to a Cigna education series and then click on today's date.
Okay, thank you so much.
No problem.
As a reminder, that's star 1 for questions. And it appears there are no further questions at this time. I'll turn the call back over to our speakers for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you so much for listening today. It was a pleasure talking with you all.
I agree. Thank you very much. Just remember, recovery is not only possible, it's a reality. And you're not alone. Thank you.
Thank you so much for attending, everyone, and thank you, Tessa and Lauren, for providing such wonderful insights. Again, if you have any specific questions about the topics discussed today, please contact the outpatient team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Be sure to mark your calendars and join us for the next Drug and Alcohol Awareness Seminar next month, April 18th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time, when we'll be discussing getting the help that you need as a parent of a teen involved with drugs or alcohol. Thank you, and have a great day.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation.